South. Featured musicians include Barbara Lynn, Henry Gray, and Jimmy Duck Holmes. Again, that's KBOO at the Clinton featuring I Am the Blues, Thursday, September 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yeah, I'm so glad.
Good morning. It's right before 11 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan presents the second half of his special on TBA-17, featuring interviews with Aaron Boberg and Roya Amir Soleimani. And coming up now, top of the hour, is Intersections Radio. Sarika Mehta talks to Renee Denfield about her book, The Child Finder, as well as her work on behalf of sex trafficking victims and people who have been wrongly imprisoned. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from PD Expendables Stage and Studio Supplies. PD Expendables sells and rents to film and theater production, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Airy LED lighting. They can be reached at 503-887-5880 or pdexpendables.com. And now, Intersections Radio.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. Now, normally Stage and Studio with DMA Roberts airs at this time, but right now Stage and Studio is on a brief hiatus. But don't you worry, we are still here to fulfill your cultural artistic needs. Today is a special live in studio episode. I have a very special guest today, Portland's very own Renee Denfield. She is the author of The Child Finder, her second novel. Her first novel, The Enchanted, won critical acclaim. Renee was the chief investigator at the Public Defender's Office. She is currently an investigator and has worked hundreds of cases. And this long career has served as inspiration for these two novels. The Child Finder is the story of missing children. Naomi is an investigator who is searching for a missing child named Madison Culver. And this is in the deep, snow-filled woods, which serve as a beautiful and treacherous backdrop. In finding this child, Naomi recalls her own past as an abducted child. Renee Denfield joins me today in studio. This is Intersections Radio. Renee Denfield, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about you and your background and how this feeds into your writing. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I actually was raised here in Portland, Oregon, primarily grew up north northeast. I'm a child of a difficult history myself, and I was a journalist for some time. And about 10 years ago, I actually made a career change. I became a licensed investigator. And as you mentioned, I've had stints at working at the Public Defender's Office. Here in Portland, we have an amazing Public Defender's Office, and they do just exceptional work. For instance, they have a veterans unit where they help veterans get housing. They help innocents who are in prison. I mean, they help sex trafficking victims. Just amazing work. And I've also been a private contractor where I take on cases that I'm asked to do, including death penalty cases, again, sex trafficking victims, that sort of thing. I got into this work because I very much wanted to do something meaningful with my life and my skills. And it ended up, to my surprise, actually being the inspiration for these two novels I've written. I have to say it's been a wonderful, redemptive sort of journey for me as well.
I think we gain so much insight into this pretty unknown world of investigation and into worlds that, well, I think that they're kind of glamorized in pop culture and media for sure. But this is a very unique lens, you know, and as somebody who is diving deep into these facts and trying to solve these mysteries, basically, of real life stories. Let's talk about The Child Finder, your second novel. Why don't you give us a very brief synopsis of it in your own words?
Sure. You know, as you just brought up, it's actually, you know, inspired by my day job. And Naomi is a licensed investigator, like myself, only she's a young woman, and she specializes in finding missing children.
And you worked primarily in death penalty cases, which is very different.
It's very different. And Naomi's not me. You know, the nice thing about writing a novel is you create characters perhaps out of your own experience, but you create new people. But I have to say, one of the parts of the novel I really enjoyed was bringing some of the procedural stuff that I do in my work into the story. A lot of times we read novels based on detective characters, and I have to say they're not often very accurate. I have yet to meet a psychic investigator.
I shouldn't laugh so hard, but yeah. maybe people believe in this.
Yeah,
but,
usually those kind of novels, they're fun. But I wanted to be able to actually take the reader into a real live investigation as Naomi, the child finder, is trying to find a little missing girl named Madison, who, as you mentioned, went lost in the woods and has been presumed dead. And so the storyline follows Naomi's path as she's looking for this missing girl. And it also follows the storyline of a little girl who is being held in a very unfortunate place and the way that she survives.
Exactly. This the story gives two perspectives. It gives Naomi's search for this little girl, and it gives this little girl's perspective on what she's experiencing. And actually, that's a good segue to my next question. I want to talk a little bit about memory and survival, because Madison Culver is the little girl who is missing, and she is missing for 3 years, which is a very long period. So it felt that pretty early on, right away, she sort of casts off this shell of being Madison Culver, and she becomes this fairy tale character. And I realized later it's as a means of survival. So, and at the same time, Naomi, the investigator who is searching for her, seems to be starting to recall aspects of her own past as she was an abducted child. So talk about this issue of memory and survival.
Well, certainly. You know, you can tell reading the book, I'm fascinated with trauma, having been the victim of trauma myself. And I'm fascinated with how we survive, how we heal, how we recover. And the novel is very much about what happens when people feel trapped or when people feel lost. I think part of why it's touching a chord with people is right now a lot of us feel trapped. A lot of us feel lost in the current political climate. And it's, you know, so it's really an examination of how we survive trauma, how we get through it, how we find our way out of trauma. And I've brought a lot of my personal experience as well as work experience into it. And one way I think that people survive trauma is through the power of their imagination. And so Madison has created this fairy tale world in her mind, and she believes that she is actually a little girl called the Snow Girl, mm-hmm. which is inspired by a Russian fairy tale that her mother used to read to her. And so she escapes into this, I think, very lyrical, beautiful world of imagination. So the novel really explores that, how people develop resiliency, how important it is that we use, you know, this core of sense of self that we have, our ability to imagine a new future.
It's incredible, because the truth is this story is told from a child's perspective for half of the book, or I should say for one of the two characters, and she is experiencing abuse and trauma that is happening on these pages, but she, you know, creates this fantasy world, and I don't know if it was intentional or if it's something that happens to children who go through this trauma in order to survive rather than, I don't know what other option there would be, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And I think our culture, we don't quite understand that and we don't value it. I know for me growing up, the public library was my sanctuary. And I would go there every day after school. And the elderly librarians were kind of like my grandmas.
Oh.
And, you know, I escaped as myself experiencing trauma as a child. I escaped into a world of stories. I escaped into books. And then I would create these incredibly vivid fantasies and daydreams that I would use to escape the trauma I was experiencing. So this is something that, you know, I have firsthand experience with. And I think it's, you know, it's such a powerful thing to do, because when we have an imagination, we're essentially making a claim to ourself. We're making a statement that we have the ability to define our own story. And so when we talk nowadays about resiliency and how we foster resiliency, I think what we really should be talking about is how do we foster imagination? Because a person who can imagine, that person can imagine a new future. They can imagine a different outcome. There's so much power in our imagination.
So then, if this child is found, and I'm not even talking about Madison Culver in the story, but just children in general in your line of work, the ones who can survive the most are the ones who can create this fantasy during this traumatic period. Once these children have to return to real life, their families, which is a good thing, how does that coping work? How do they survive this shift, this transition?
Yeah, I think so it's a great question for anybody who's survived trauma, is how do we recover and heal once we're safe? Because, you know, those of us who've experienced trauma, whether it's childhood abuse or war veterans or sex abuse survivors, no matter what it is, there comes a time when we can find ourselves in a physically safe place, but we still have a lot of healing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what I believe is there's so much that we can do for each other in that way. I believe we really need to accept people for their experiences and love them for their experiences, including their trauma. For instance, I adopted my kids from foster care.
Mm-hmm.
And
you have three kids.
I have three kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll stop myself from bragging about them because they're amazing.
That's what we mothers do.
I love my kids. And adopting from foster care was the best choice I ever made. And I got to go on a journey with my kids. I think it's a healing journey. And I've often told them, I love you, including what's happened to you. And I love them for all that they are, including their experiences of trauma, not despite the trauma, but including it. So I think that that's a really central part to any sort of healing and recovery, is really being accepted and accepting each other for these experiences.
That's a really important point to say, I love you, including your trauma, not despite it. And in fact, going back to the book, Madison Culver, The Missing Child, again, very early on, when she finds that she is, you know, in this captive situation, as the story goes on, she clearly has an affection and an adoration for this. I mean, it, from the outside perspective, he's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
He is abusing this child. But she has an adoration and she adores him and she wants to protect him at times and even tell him it's okay. Talk about that part of the story.
You know, one of the things I've encountered and I'm fascinated with is what people call Stockholm syndrome sometimes. I think it's a bigger question than that. But what happens when we have feelings for those who hurt us? And it's something I think a lot of people can relate to, because we often find ourselves in a situation where we might have a family member who is perhaps, not healthy for us.
Mm-hmm.
We might find ourselves with a brother that's in and out of prison, or perhaps a parent who has a mental illness that refuses to get treatment. And it's part of life where we can find ourselves caring about people that hurt us.
And you defend them.
Yeah, and you defend them. It's a complicated issue, and I don't think that we are often really given a roadmap for how to handle that. There's a lot of kind of finger-pointing in our society, and people mm-hmm. say, well, you should just dump so-and-so, mm-hmm. or you should just get that person out of your life.
Or it's your fault for not leaving.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's so beautiful point, because that very quickly puts all the pressure on the victim. And we don't, I think, really provide people with that kind of roadmap of, like, what do you do when you care about somebody that's hurting you? And that's very true for childhood victims of abuse. A lot of times their abusers are people that they care for. And I really wanted to explore through the Madison character
mm-hmm.
what that's like. And I found it really important that I wanted to center and honor her experiences. I felt a lot of the book was kind of pushing back against the shame that people are given around childhood abuse. And really pushing back against that, because Madison is intent upon making this experience survivable for herself.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the truth is that, first of all, it's cyclical. This is something, the abuse is passed down, and You write a lot of humanity into the characters who experience this and who do it, who are the abusers. And I imagine, especially with your background and experiences, that couldn't have been easy.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's difficult. But I think it's really important in our society that we start really talking about these things. And I'm really interested in prevention. And we can't prevent what we don't understand. And the truth is, most men, for instance, that commit crimes against women, they're our neighbors, coaches, sometimes our family members. They're people in our society. I think it's tempting as a writer, sometimes people want to depict these sort of men as monsters. But that does a real disservice to the problem, because we really need to grapple that so much violence is created and it's preventable and it's societal. And it comes out of a lot of different causes, including the cycles of abuse. I really wish that we would spend more time as a society preventing childhood abuse, because I think we would stop a lot of these cycles from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in no way at all to minimize what happens. In fact, I think it's important to honor the victims. And my way of doing that is wanting us to grapple with why this happened so we can stop it.
I want to talk about another character in the story. Well, you know, you briefly mentioned the foster system, because you have adopted three children in the foster system in real life. And and in the story, another case comes up for Naomi. She takes on two cases simultaneously, which she doesn't often do. And it's the Danita Danforth case. This is a different case altogether than Madison Culver. Maybe you can describe it for us.
Sure. You know, I was writing the book, and when I'm writing, it's like falling down this delicious rabbit hole. I just get so caught up in the story. And when I'm writing, it can feel, it's very lyrical. There's parts of the book that are very poetic. And it just feels like the story starts pouring out of me. And I first heard the voice of Madison, the snow girl. And when I got into writing the book, all of a sudden this other case kind of pops up, this secondary case of the book, the Danita Danforth case. And it's a completely different storyline. And it examines a young, poor black woman whose baby has gone missing. And Naomi's working this case as well. And when the storyline came up, I thought, oh no, this is going to get very complicated. But then I very quickly realized that this was a chance to examine another aspect of missing children and missing women. And that is, unfortunately, there is a lot of racism and bias, I think, in our culture about which cases get the attention and which don't. And, you know, that this storyline, you know, is played out at the same time as the other storylines are. And I found it, you know, it just felt like a very important story to tell of what happens when it's a young black mother whose child has gone missing, as opposed to a little white girl.
Exactly. A little white girl named Madison versus, you know, a black woman whose name is Danita and her child is missing. And in fact, it's revealed that Danita is actually autistic, and that went undiagnosed, her educational needs weren't met appropriately. Talk about what happens in the system with, you know, these children and these families when, I mean, there's a point in the book where one of Naomi's friends, who is a child psychologist, says, you know, black kids don't get diagnosed, they just are labeled as bad.
Yes, exactly. I'm so glad that you picked up on that. You know, it's something I personally witnessed in my work and in my life. I was raised in a biracial family, and my kids are all African American, and attend and live in a neighborhood, 10 neighborhood schools, and we live in a very diverse neighborhood. So this is something I've had a lot of experience with. And you know, unfortunately, it's true. You know, that line comes up in the book that black children don't get diagnosed as autistic; they just get diagnosed as bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, sadly, that all too often happens. That when an African American child is exhibiting any sort of struggle, it's often interpreted by teachers and everyone else as a behavioral problem, with often some sort of problem assigned to the mother. But they're seen as behavioral problems. And I think you could probably find a bunch of studies. In fact, I know you can find a bunch of studies to back this up, but I want to tell the real life stories of what happens to these children who do go undiagnosed for what's actually happening neurologically with them or something like autism. And instead, they get labeled and maligned and stigmatized. And again, this is something I've seen a lot of in my own life as well. And it's really a shame. So not only do we have, you know, the bias, there's a lot of bias, for instance, it's an astonishing number, but there's at least 40,000 missing women in the United States.
And at least 40,000 missing women.
At least 40,000 missing women in the United States. And every year about at least 1,000 children go missing. And if you think of the news reports that you've seen on missing kids, you will probably remember, like, locally and nationally, every now and then one usually blonde white child gets a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. But for every one of those blonde white children that gets attention, there are literally hundreds or thousands more. There's just a lot of bias in our system about which children our society seems to care about and which ones our society doesn't seem to care about.
And this whole story is looking at how this affects Madison's family and you know, for a part of it, for a chunk of the story, how this affects Danita's family. Because like you said in the news, we hear how this may, you know, we may see the parents of the missing child, of the missing white child on the news, but we don't hear what's going to happen with all of the other children who are missing, who are children of color.
Yeah, exactly. They just don't, they're just not on the news, but they certainly exist.
Right.
You know, and, you know, in my neighborhood, there's been cases where young black girls go missing, and I look in the local newspapers and don't find any coverage of it. So, you know, it's just, it's really sad. And, of course, their families and those children are just as important.
Exactly.
As anybody else. And in the Danforth storyline of this novel, you know, one thing I kind of wanted to examine was how the mother is assumed guilty also.
Right, she's in jail when
she's
Naomi's
in jail.
Talking to her.
Yes, and so when the black mom's child goes missing, there's an immediate kind of assumption of guilt. And, you know, I kind of spent a little bit of time in the book kind of unraveling all the discrimination and bias this family has faced. And the outcome, I won't give away what's happened to that mm-hmm. child because it's very sad, but that, again, is a case that is completely preventable had this family been given the supports and given the help that they needed. And I found that to be true in my work. Most of the cases I've worked have been preventable.
Can you give an example from your cases? Because we don't want to give away the spoilers in the book, but we can talk about your cases to give a picture to our listeners.
You know, I've worked just so many different kinds of cases. I can tell you, doing the death penalty work, that pretty much every case I've had I felt was preventable. We talked about the cycles of abuse. Mm-hmm. And this in no way, in any way, minimizes what these people have done.
Right.
But when I conduct investigations into some of these people, I find just these horrific histories of childhood abuse and neglect. And so many times where our society really dropped the ball, where they might have been repeatedly returned to family members that abused them, where people didn't report what was happening. And I think you go back so many of these cases, and you can very easily imagine a different outcome. I think our society, we want to label a lot of these people who do terrible things. But as I said earlier, I'm more interested in understanding it so that we can hopefully pursue more programs to stop it.
Yeah, prevention. Well, prevention, you know, was what you were talking about. And I want to talk about the ending of this book without giving away spoilers. I always, that's why I put the onus on you to give things in your own words. Because what I will say is it kind of takes an unexpected turn. There is a narrative shift. And throughout the story, Naomi's past is coming back to her in pieces. And so we are also kind of, it's a page turner. We also kind of want to know what happened to Naomi that leads her to this point. And I, can I say that we are left with some questions? I'll say that.
Yes. And you know, you brought up memory earlier, and I'm very fascinated with memory, what we remember, what we don't. And I would take a very victim-centered sort of approach. You know, my feeling about the end of the book is that it's, to me, it's actually a very hopeful book and it's very uplifting in a way. And that's another outcome of my work. You know, often people, I've been doing the investigative stuff for quite a while, and often people will say to me they would expect that it would have made me cynical or despairing.
Right.
But actually, it's had the opposite of impact on me, because for every terrible thing that I see happen, and people are capable of committing such harm, but for every one of those terrible things, I witness countless instances of people being courageous and brave and trying to help each other. You know, if you think about all the footage from the floods recently in Texas, mm-hmm. how, you know, average citizens went out in boats to save people they never met. You know, I see so much of that sort of courage in my work, and I see so much of how strong the human spirit is. That, like people like Madison, how people will do all they can to survive even the most horrific sort of situations and come out the other end. So the ending of the book, I think, was very much imbued with that sort of spirit. I really believe in humanity, and I believe in hope, and I believe that we all have the power to save each other. Part of that's our responsibility. But I think we also have a responsibility to each other, just to reach out as much as we can, even if it's just a little act, like checking in on a family down the street or volunteering to help teach kids how to read. Mm-hmm. That when we embrace that sort of collective humanity, it's actually awe-inspiring, and it's very redemptive.
That's very... That's hopeful to hear that, you know.
I didn't give away the ending, I don't think.
I want to talk about, we only have a couple of minutes, and I want to talk about one thing that we had, you and I had started chatting before this started, this program started. We are both mothers and pursuing careers and arts and also being true to ourselves and being there for our children. Mm-hmm. So talk about how it has been to be a writer and an investigator before having children and during, and now your children are grown.
My children are now older. They're now 14, 20, and 22.
So they don't really need, you know, babysitters.
They don't know. I get to go out now. You know, it's so hard to be an artist, period. But I think to be a mom and an artist and having a day job is super tough. And it's so hard for us women in particular, because we get so much pressure to try to be super mom and to do everything. And it was just really hard. I mean, I had years where I was not able to write. I had years where what writing I did went nowhere. It's so tough to be a writer, which is why I think it's so wonderful to live in a town where the writers here support each other. Because there's, for every book that comes out, you know, we all have like long periods where nothing happened. I will say that one of the things I had to do as a mom was I learned to prioritize my art. And when I'm writing, you know, there's dust bunnies that grow into entire herds. they collect under the furniture, because, you know, you can't be super mom and be an artist too. So I had to learn how to balance things and let some things go.
That's good. You know, I mean, it's a reality.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's tough. And when children are young, they take an emotional energy that's mm-hmm. different. And I found actually now that my kids are older, my world is just kind of expanding, and I'm in my late 40s, and it feels like the most creative, joyous time of my life. So for any of those writers who are out there struggling, thinking they have to do something by a certain age, you don't. It'll happen.
That's a very good note to wrap up this wonderful conversation. Renee Denfeld, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
And thank you so much for having me. It's been a total pleasure.
That was my guest, Portland's very own Renee Denfeld, author of The Child Finder, which is out in bookshelves now. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast. And join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sari Gametha. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Vibe's Grand Opening Weekend and 10th Birthday, Friday, September 22nd at Vibe in Portland. Vibe's Grand Opening Weekend and 10th Birthday will unveil Vibe of Portland's new studio along with a celebration of a decade of empowering kids through art. Again, that's Vibe's Grand Opening Weekend and 10th Birthday, Friday, September 22nd at 7 p.m. at Vibe of Portland's new studio at 5633 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next at 11:30 is Art Focus. Joseph Gallivan presents the second half of his special on TBA-17, featuring interviews with Aaron Boberg and Roya Amir Soleimani. Art Focus is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Oregon Symphony, presenting a special concert, Angelique Kidjo, with the Oregon Symphony. More info and tickets for this event with Angelique Kidjo at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall on Tuesday, September 26th, available now at orsymphony.org.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests again this week are Roya Amir Soleimani and Aaron Boberg. They're from the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, and they've come back again this week to talk about TBA 17, the Time-Based Art Festival, which is carrying on now through September 17th. Thanks for coming back to KBOO.
Thank you for having us.
So with the festival halfway done, today's Tuesday, there are still some really good things that are actually happening today, Tuesday. So we just want to talk about what's left in the festival. And one of the big names you have is